Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, who assesses the most recent round of protests confronting police violence in Ferguson and St. Louis, Missouri. Josh Rovner of the Sentencing Project, who discusses a recent report on the abuse of adolescent inmates in New York City prisons and the larger issue of violence in the nation's juvenile justice system. And Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon, who talks about why he believes the Obama administration's prosecution of New York Times investigative reporter James Risen constitutes a threat to all journalists and press freedom. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta is the world's first head of state to appear before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Kenyatta, who was indicted 2 years ago for his role in post-election violence in 2007, was elected in 2013. He recently appeared before a status conference where prosecutors claimed the Kenyan government was withholding evidence in the war crimes case. The ICC indictment charges that Kenyatta organized mob violence in the Rift Valley, targeting political opponents following the disputed 2007 presidential election. Overall, 1,200 people were killed and over 600,000 were forced to flee their homes after then-President Mwai Kibaki, an ally of Kenyatta, was hurriedly inaugurated for a second and final term in office, despite claims by opposition candidate Raila Odinga that the result had been rigged. Kenyatta's lawyer, Stephen Kay, urged the ICC to drop the case. In December, an ICC panel stated it would be inappropriate for the prosecution to withdraw these charges at this stage in light of the Kenyan government's continuing failure to cooperate fully with the court's request for documents and records related to the charges. The prosecutor's case has been damaged by many witnesses' refusal to testify, growing frustration among victims of the 2007 violence, and the ICC's poor image in Africa. Back in 2010, gay rights activists in the conservative state of Utah expected a decades-long fight to legalize same-sex marriage. Instead, gay marriage is now the law of the land in Utah and many other socially conservative states after the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear appeals of gay marriage rulings made by lower courts from the governors of Utah, Oklahoma, Indiana, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Recent rulings expanded the number of states that allow same-sex marriage to 30, along with the District of Columbia. Utah's same-sex marriage case, known as Kitchen v. Hebert, sought to overturn Amendment 3, which passed overwhelmingly in a 2004 statewide referendum that defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Prospects for repealing the law changed dramatically in 2013 when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act. In Oklahoma, the Supreme Court ruling will mean the GOP-dominated state must drop gender requirements from marriage licenses. The Sixth District Court of Appeals in Cincinnati is expected to issue a ruling soon on challenges to gay marriage bans in Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio. Thus far, no federal appeals court has upheld a state's gay marriage ban. If the Sixth District Court rules to support the ban, the Supreme Court may intervene and issue a declarative ruling on gay marriage that would set the standard in all 50 states. After running unsuccessfully for mayor in 2013, former city councilor Dan Samuels, now seeking election to the Minneapolis School Board, has attracted large donations from education reform groups backed by billionaires and hedge fund managers. Thus far, Samuels has raised 4 times the campaign funds collected by his main opponent, incumbent Rebecca Gagnon. According to the news magazine In These Times, Samuels has raised big bucks from California billionaire Arthur Rock, funneled through the 50 Can Action Fund. Rock also supports Leadership in Education Equity, the political action arm of Teach for America that advocates the expansion of charter schools. So what are out-of-state investors hoping to gain by helping Don Samuels get on the Minneapolis School Board? The answer may lie in the well-documented billionaire-led push by education reform proponents to privatize the nation's public school system. This is often accomplished through the efforts to expand school choice through district and charter school competition, with the accompanying goals of weakening or eliminating both teachers' unions and democratically elected school boards. The infamous Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has also used its political muscle to push pro-charter bills through state legislatures across the country. This is all part of a pattern that's playing out in states, including Texas, Oregon, Colorado, and New Jersey, where local school board races have been heavily influenced by the political and financial heft of outside anti-union education reform groups. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Two months after the day in August that Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old African-American, was shot to death by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, a weekend of resistance was launched to focus public attention on the urgent need to address police violence in communities of color. The rallies, marches, and civil disobedience actions, known as Ferguson October, drew thousands of activists locally and from around the nation. Just 2 days before the protests were scheduled to get underway, another 18-year-old African-American, Vondra Myers, was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer in St. Louis. Police say that Myers shot at police first, but his family members maintain he was unarmed. The protesters staged actions in both Ferguson and St. Louis at multiple sites that included police headquarters, City Hall, a political fundraiser, a university campus, and a Walmart store. Among the activists who demanded the arrest and prosecution of Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot Michael Brown, were religious and union leaders. Well-known activist and author Professor Cornel West, who participated in a civil disobedience action modeled on the Moral Mondays movement, was arrested with more than 40 others at the Ferguson Police Department. At an interfaith rally the night before, young activists expressed frustration at the tepid protest tactics practiced by their elders, maintaining that more militant action was needed to confront police violence and the lack of accountability. "Missouri is the new Mississippi," said Tef Poe, a young St. Louis hip-hop artist and Hands Up United organizer. Your reporter spoke with activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, co-editor of the new book titled Killing Trayvons, an Anthology of American Violence. Here, Gray assesses the most recent round of protests in Missouri and the growing movement to confront police violence nationwide.
One person of color is killed in this country every 28 hours by police or under the color of law. In South Carolina this year, I think we've had over 35 police shootings. So this isn't something new that just happened with Michael Brown. It's something that has been going on a long time. I'm glad the country is starting to pay attention to it, that young folk are starting to pay attention to it and understand what racism and skin privilege is all about. I'm glad they're understanding the issues involving policing and police departments and making sure that police as citizens are held to the same standards as it relates to their culpability for committing a crime. And there's a movement that's developing. But we still have to figure out ways in every community, not just Ferguson. Ferguson is the focal point right now, as Sanford, Florida was the focal point when Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman under the guise of Stand Your Ground or under the color of Stand Your Ground. But we have to put together a movement that really holds people accountable, that doesn't just focus on the individual tragedy, that recognizes that we have a problem with police violence and policing, that we have a problem with the militarization of the police departments, that we have a problem with racial profiling, that we have a problem with the war on drugs, that we have a problem with how people view black males in general and black people in particular. There are a lot of issues that have to be put on the table, and they all don't reside solely in Ferguson.
Kevin, what is the mindset that has to be challenged head-on that exists in so many police departments across this country in terms of how they conduct themselves when they're in communities of color that results, obviously, in violence and the deaths of Michael Brown and hundreds, thousands of others over the years?
Well, something has to be done to test a lot of police and to really find out if, in fact, they ought to have that job. There are police that are just straight up racist or sadist. and they don't need to be on police departments. There's a lot of, I would argue there are a lot of police that they're in it for the power. They believe that they are the law, not that they're enforcing the peace, or even if you want to use the term enforcing the law and this and fall and, you know, because I don't know if I really like this term law enforcement. People respect the law. People respect the people who are tasked with serving and protecting and being fair to everybody as they do their jobs. That's what makes the law work, when people respect the law, not when there are people who believe that they are the law and believe that you have to acquiesce to them because they have a badge and you have to be subservient to them because they have a badge and they can kill you at will because they have a badge.
During the civil rights movement, there was a multiracial coalition that pushed forward on civil rights that many credit with an effective protest movement that actually won the day. How important is it that this new burgeoning movement against police violence be multiracial and cross over into many different communities across the United States?
Obviously, it's white kids and white people understanding what skin privilege is and what it means. And, you know, the progressive movement is about building multiracial, multi-issue coalitions. That's what progressivism is. It's not about narrow black nationalism or pseudo-black nationalism or pseudo-white nationalism or liberalism or Democratic Party politics. Is about having a set of progressive ideals that you believe in. You're against the drug war. You're against the police state. You're against government power to kill without due process. You're for the so-called beloved community that Dr. King talked about. And economically, how do we make that happen? Because it all goes hand in hand. We're concerned about poverty. We're concerned about the least of thee. We're talking about building an egalitarian, fair community, a community that looks beyond race and stereotypes, that tries to reconcile history, that tries to make amends for history and understand what it's really about. That is the essence of what progressive politics is about. The troubling thing about Ferguson is that we get focused on young black men, and no question that young black men are a group that is targeted. But there are people of color, brown folk, suffer under abuse because of immigration and other issues. Black women suffer. Poor people suffer. So, you know, we have to be about building that movement. And when people understand it's the 1% that's running this country that has this police force, this police state in place to keep everybody at bay and keep everybody fighting one another, as soon as we realize that, then we'll be building a movement, and that movement will be successful, and we'll change government in this country.
That was activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, co-editor of the book Killing Trayvons, an Anthology of American Violence. For more commentary on the organized response to police violence in communities of color, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In August, the U.S. Attorney for Manhattan, Preet Bharara, issued a report charging that the New York City Department of Correction had systematically violated the civil rights of young male prisoners 16 to 18 years old held at Rikers Island by failing to protect them from the rampant use of unnecessary and excessive force by abusive correction officers. The report described a deep-seated culture of violence against youthful inmates at the jail complex, perpetrated by guards who operated with little fear of punishment. It singled out for blame a powerful code of silence among the Rikers Island prison staff, along with a virtually useless system for investigating charges against guards made by inmates. The report found that the result was a staggering number of injuries among adolescent inmates. U.S. Attorney Bharara warned that if the city did not work cooperatively to develop new policies and procedures, the Justice Department could file a federal lawsuit asking a judge to order the imposition of remedies. On the date the report was issued, August 4th, Bharara gave the city 49 days to respond to the investigation's findings. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Josh Rovner, state advocacy associate with a sentencing project, who talks about the investigation and the larger problem of criminally charging teenagers as adults and taking a hard line on minor offenses.
The federal investigation reveals things that shock the conscience, but one would have to be blind to think that those abuses are unique to the three buildings that the U.S. Attorney's Office happened to investigate. They didn't even look at the girls' prisons. They found a deep-seated culture of violence. That's not the prisoners, that's the guards. And those guards had little fear of being punished.
New York is one of only two states that treat 16-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system. What impact do you think that may have had on the level of violence directed against them?
New York State is one of just two states that treat everyone over 16 as an adult. North Carolina is the other. And I think it's important to get this exactly correct, because New York State says if you're accused of a crime at 16, you're an adult. But you're still a teenager when you apply for a driver's license, if you want to get married or buy alcohol or cigarettes. When it comes to the justice system, they're willing to make an exception. 16-year-olds are occasionally adults in New York State. All of the science disagrees with this view. Adolescent brains are still developing. Even teenagers who do make mistakes, though, have a capacity for reform.
Until a few years ago, Connecticut also considered 16 and 17-year-olds adults in the criminal justice system. Do you have any comparative data on New York and Connecticut since the change?
Connecticut did raise the age back in 2007. They passed a law, and that went into effect on New Year's Day 2010. Connecticut joined the mainstream on that. And did their crime go up? No. Juvenile arrest rates in Connecticut fell from 22,000 in 2008 to 13,000 in 2011. That's the last year for which there's data, and that's a 41% drop. Let's compare that to New York State. 2008, there were 102,000 arrests. 2011, 120,000 arrests of juveniles. That's an 18% increase. Being tough on crime doesn't work. These are federal counts, and so these are everyone, they count juveniles as being 10 to 17 years old. So whether the state is treating juveniles as juveniles, they are still counted under the federal data.
So the U.S. Attorney's Office issued a report, and the New York Times also did an expose on the issue.
I think what is so awful about this study is that we discovered that the data that was available is completely inadequate. The teenagers were afraid to report what was happening. The New York Times, in their additional study, found that corrections officials had sanitized the data. I mean, that's a polite way to say that they lied, that the abuses and fights and beatings were even worse. The teenagers don't report the abuse for fear of retribution. So the data that we have is incomplete. The federal report issues 80 recommendations. I think the most important is removing teenagers entirely from Rikers. That system is broken for juveniles.
Josh Rovner, does the government report suggest where these teens should be held?
They ought to be in community-based programs closer to home. The New Yorker had this remarkable piece about Caleb Browder. 16 years old, he was being investigated for stealing a backpack. The police said he stole it. Caleb said he didn't. I mean, this is what we have courts for, and he sat at Rikers for 3 years because of a backlog of cases. You know, the question of whether we need to be locking up low-level offenders in the first place is a key question.
What other of the 86 recommendations do you think are the most important?
You know, they also recommended taking teenagers out of solitary confinement, which is something that all the adolescent development experts would agree with as well. Mayor de Blasio announced, in fact, they are going to end solitary confinement for teenagers there as of December 31st. When the announcement was made, there were 51 teenagers in solitary confinement at Rikers. Kids can be put into solitary confinement for things like horseplay and talking back and having more clothing than they're entitled to there. It was something that was completely being abused. One thing I find very interesting in all of this is that the mayor's office has said that this change to solitary confinement was not in response to the report. I'm really wondering when it is that the mayor is going to respond to this report. There was a deadline of late September. We are now about 2 weeks past that deadline. Has anyone been fired, disciplined, reassigned? The mayor's office hasn't said so, and even worse, warden and deputy warden of the facility have been promoted. It's an outrage. When you have a broken system and you're looking at that many recommendations, there's a lot to be done. It really starts with moving kids out of the facility and not locking up lower-level offenders in the first place.
That was Josh Rovner, State Advocacy Associate with the Sentencing Project. Find more perspectives on the abuse of adolescent inmates inside the nation's juvenile justice system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For more than 6 years, New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author James Risen has been the target of federal prosecutors for his refusal to disclose his sources. The Department of Justice has ordered Risen to testify against one of his alleged sources, former CIA agent Jeffrey Sterling, who is believed to have provided the journalist with confidential information regarding a failed CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear weapons program, which was published in his 2006 book, State of War. Thus far, Risen has refused to cooperate with prosecutors and identify his source, stating that he would rather go to jail than give up everything he believes in. An article published on the front page of The Nation magazine on October 8th, titled "The Government War Against Reporter James Risen," examines the Obama administration's pattern of retaliating against independent journalists and whistleblowers, which the authors say undermines freedom of the press, an essential foundation for a healthy democracy. The article, written by Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon and Marcy Wheeler, asserts that the prosecution of Risen and Sterling is designed to conceal controversial and embarrassing aspects of U.S. foreign policy from the American people and intimidate future government whistleblowers and journalists who would tell their stories. During 6 years of the Obama administration, whistleblower investigations, opened under the 1917 Espionage Act, is more than double the number of those conducted in all previous presidential administrations combined. In recent months, more than 100,000 people have signed a petition demanding that the federal government stop its prosecution of James Risen. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, a former California congressional candidate, an author and activist, who talks about why he believes the prosecution of James Risen constitutes a threat to all journalists and press freedom.
The public not only had a right to know, but a necessity to know the information that Risen published. And as we say at the close of our article, which I think really is for the first time a layout of these complicated interweaved stories all in one place, if the indictment is true and Jeffrey Sterling actually provided this vital information about a dangerous and botched CIA operation regarding nuclear weapons diagrams, then we owe Jeffrey Sterling a great debt of gratitude for serving as a whistleblower in the public interest. If the indictment is false and Jeffrey Sterling was not a source for this information in James Risen's book, then we also owe Jeffrey Sterling a debt of gratitude because everybody agrees that he went through channels to the Senate Intelligence Committee and met with two staffers to express his concern and provide information about this really reckless CIA operation. So no matter what, Jeffrey Sterling is being subjected to legal assault from the Justice Department for doing the right thing.
Norman, there's been some recent developments in the case that you wrote something about, and that had to do with a 60 Minutes interview with a former CIA and NSA director, Michael Hayden. He was asked about this case. What did he say?
Yes, well, Michael Hayden appeared on 60 Minutes, and I can quote him here. He's talking about the breach of classification of information and what was published about this, what was called Operation Merlin by the CIA vis-a-vis nuclear blueprints to Iran. And I'm quoting Michael Hayden on 60 Minutes. "That was a terrible thing to do. America will suffer because of that story," unquote. Well, that's pure unadulterated nonsense. There's no evidence that there was any harm done other than embarrassment to the United States government or the United States or anybody else by the publication of this information in James Risen's book. What we do know is that by sharing this information, the public learned more about just how dangerous the CIA operations were and how, frankly, dumb they were. Harebrained, not well thought out, ill-conceived, to put it mildly. Ironically, there was a lot of damage to CIA operations during the Bush administration in Iran, and that damage was entirely self-inflicted, as we cite in our article reported by Risen himself. So this is classic, where the government screws up, it does stuff that cannot withstand the light of day, it is botched, it is embarrassing, it is messed up, and often dangerous, and often, unfortunately, during the war on terror, murderous in terms of use of drones and so forth. And yet, rather than acknowledge any mistakes or moral failings whatsoever, the hierarchy of the CIA and the White House and so forth insist that we're supposed to blame whistleblowers for being truth tellers and now going after a journalist as well. And our article in The Nation talks about how this is a context of a full court press assault on investigative journalism as a whole in this country. And we certainly don't have time to go into all the details, but I'm very appreciative that this article in The Nation has the space to really spell this out in detail.
Norman, certainly the important core of this article and this campaign is press freedom and democracy. Tell our listeners what you believe is at stake in this case with James Risen and Jeffrey Sterling in terms of freedom of the press as it relates to national security issues and democracy overall.
Really essential is the capacity for journalists and the public to learn about and share information that is not provided by people in power. And if the Obama administration gets its way, then the public will learn almost nothing about foreign policy, about so-called national security matters, military actions. We will learn virtually nothing that people at the top of the government don't want us to know. And that's not the informed consent of the governed. That's the uninformed consent of the governed, which is the goal of this administration quite clearly, as Marcy Wheeler and I map out in the article in The Nation. And if we have the uninformed consent of the governed, then democracy's got nothing to do with it. It becomes simply government doing what it wants and the public just watching.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Find links to Solomon's recent Nation magazine article on James Risen and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.